You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with our naked Daniel Freeman.
I'm not naked. Don't put people off.
And a clothed Lionel Burney.
Much to everyone's relief.
Phew. Yeah, well, certainly.
I'm wearing a Gymshark t-shirt, Richard.
It's a bit early for the advertising, is it not, Lionel? Lionel Burney appears courtesy of Gymshark. Thank you, Lionel. How are you both? Obviously, you're quite hot, I would say, Daniel, judging by your lack of attire.
Oh, God. Can we move past this and just talk about...
It's difficult to move past it when I've got your naked torso staring at me.
I'm always trying to haul you back onto the cycling and stop going off on these tangents.
You could always have worn a t-shirt for this video call.
Yes.
I mean, radical idea, I know.
Yes. But... I'm okay. I've been doing a bit of the old cycling, actually.
Have you?
Yeah.
Been riding your bike?
Well, yeah, I've got a bike, one of my old bikes, my old Decathlon 9.2 series, purchased in 1999, I think. Columbus Ultra Foco, I think it was called, tubing. Absolutely splendid. It's tremendous. Absolutely rapid.
We've also, having not been watching a bit of cycling, the bit being the operative word there, I think, but bike racing returned to our screens on Sunday, didn't it? What a glorious occasion that was. A Slovenian National Road Race Championship.
Didn't so much stream as trickle. It wasn't even a trickle, was it?
Yeah, we paid €5 to watch it. You and I, Daniel, did, certainly. Lionel had some prior intelligence that his €5 would be better spent elsewhere. But we gave it a go, didn't we? We gave it a good go, and it wasn't quite up to scratch, the coverage, was it?
Not really. I don't really watch car programs, motoring programs, but I feel intimately familiar with the workings of a Citroën. I don't even know what model it was, but it was a white Citroën that the race director was driving. I feel as though I could give a comprehensive analysis of its cornering capabilities. But next year, Rich, I think rather than shell out €5 each, I think there were about 350 people watching at times, weren't there? 400 people. I think we should all have a whip round and see if we can persuade Pog to just FaceTime the whole race, and we'll pay his roaming charges. About 3.5 hours, was it, the race?
Yeah, I'm not sure there'll be the same interest next year in the Slovenian National Road Race Championship. I think this was a special occasion, so that business opportunity may have gone.
So what actually happened? What was the problem with the pictures?
What pictures?
The pictures were, the streaming was, should we say, jumpy and a bit sporadic, but the main problem was that the cameraman on the back of, well, the semi-official motorbike, it seemed to be, he was not allowed to overtake the race director's car. So the whole race and what we saw of it was filmed from behind the race director's car, which was behind the peloton. So the race itself really delivered on what it was billed as, this Rog Pog Royal Showdown, Royal Rumble, and it really did deliver, because they were left on their own or on the final climb. The race finished up quite a sizable climb, wasn't it, Rich? About an 8 kilometer climb, I think it was. So we suspected that those two might slug it out, and they did, but we didn't really see any of it. And Rog got the better of Pog with an attack in the last 600 metres or so. But there was a bit of a postscript, because we discovered later that Pogacar had crashed. And he might have been slightly hampered by that.
Yeah, for new listeners, that's Primož Roglič and Tadej Pogačar, the two Slovenian superstars. It was good to see them go head-to-head like that, because in a national road race, you don't sometimes, the course was obviously selective enough to pull out the cream of the crop, and they did slug it out, as you say, Daniel, which was good to see. Unfortunately, I missed the finish. I popped out to my shed and came back and realised I just missed the finish, having sort of persevered with it for rather too long.
Well, I do feel, my final analysis was that it was worth it, because I didn't pick up, I didn't understand too much of the commentary, but one thing I did pick up was that, and I checked this subsequently, Pog's first ever club, was called Rog. Pog used to ride for Rog, and now he rides against Rog. Ljubljana Rog, I think it was called.
Right. We've got, this is our press conference episode, which we normally do during Grand Tours, but we decided to do following our Giro, and that's a couple of weeks ago now. But we've got some of your questions. We will hear them in this episode. We'll also hear a longer interview that we've done. More details on that a bit later on.
Rich, can I ask, can we start with a question from me?
Certainly.
What's going on with Mitchelton Scott and the Manuela Fundación?
Well, I don't know if that will be covered in your news roundup.
We haven't got to the news roundup. Sorry, Napalm.
Yeah.
There's
just a couple of notes, really, a couple of things to update people on. Well, the Slovenian National Championships, the men's road race, as you say, won by Primož Roglič ahead of Tadej Pogačar. And Matej Mohoric was third. As you say, good to see some bike racing back. I mean, that clearly makes Roglic and Pogacar favourites 1 and 2 for the Tour de France. I mean, there's no other form to go on. That's it. I mean, end of story. Slovenian 1-2 at the
Tour. Not unfeasible.
Konstantin Siutsu, the Belarusian rider who rode for Team Sky between 2012 and 2015, then joined Dimension Data and then Bahrain Merida. He's been handed a 4-year ban after testing positive for EPO during July 2018. His career came to an end basically with that incident, didn't it? He'd crashed wrecking the course of the prologue at the Giro d'Italia in Jerusalem earlier that year. I don't think came back and raced again after that, but a 4-year doping ban for Siutsu, who had retired anyway. The two big stories that we want to get to the bottom of, Daniel, you mentioned one, we'll come to that in a minute, but Chris Froome as well. We did a little postscript in last week's news roundup because the Times had a story suggesting that Chris Froome to the Israel Cycling Academy might be on the cards in time for the Tour de France at the end of August. Any updates on that at all, Richard?
Not really. The thing that's been notable for me is that there's been no comment from Team Ineos, and the three points of this triangle are Froome, Israel and Ineos, and one suspects that the story last week was driven by Froome and possibly the Israel Startup Nation team, who would no doubt love to have Chris Froome lining up with them at the Tour de France. I just cannot see Ineos letting Froome go. He's apparently not been offered a new contract. He is out of contract at the end of the year. But I can't see them letting him go before the Tour, even if they think he's got no chance of winning the Tour. I do think a more likely scenario is that he's not selected for the Tour and maybe sent to the Vuelta instead. It's probably not an important detail, but Ineos are making a film and have invested a bit in making a documentary following Froome's comeback from his crash last year. In chatting to someone from Ineos, they mentioned that the film would sort of culminate in his comeback at a Grand Tour, which may be the Tour de France or maybe the Vuelta. So, you know, I think the silence from Ineos on this is quite telling, and I can understand why Froome would want to go if he thinks that, you know, he might not be picked for the Tour. I can understand why Israel would want him. I cannot understand why Ineos would let him go before his contract expires.
I called them Israel Cycling Academy there. Apologies for that. It's Israel Startup Nation, of course.
Still calling EF Garmin.
I know. It's one of the things. It takes me 2 years
Movistar
to catch up
Reynolds.
With the team. Yeah. Big fan of the Peugeot team still. I like them a lot. Thank heavens for Cofidis. They've just stayed the same for 20-odd years. But I'll, whatever happens, I'll still be calling Manuela Fundación Mitchelton Scott for a good couple of seasons yet. But Daniel, this story has kind of flipped and flopped one way and the other, hasn't it? It was on, it's off, it's on, it's off again. What's the latest here? This is the suggestion that a charitable foundation based in Granada in southern Spain, the Manuela Fundación, is taking quite a big chunk of the Mitchelton Scott team and certainly taking over the title sponsorship. And then the team's chief backer, Jerry Ryan, gave some interviews last week saying that that wasn't the case and they were going to stay as they are. But I gather that's not the end of the story.
No, Napalm. A bit of a tricky one to get your head around. So most professional cycling teams, or a lot of professional cycling teams at the top level, they consist of a kind of management company, which are often known as, well, which in kind of UCI regulations and so forth are referred to as the paying agent. And then you can get a sponsor which sits above them. And the way Mitchelton Scott is set up is that there's a company called Green Edge, I think Green Edge Cycling, and Jerry Ryan, who is the businessman who, to all intents and purposes, has funded the team for a long time. He's the owner of that company, and he's also the owner of the Mitchelton Scott World Tour license. However, there's another company which is owned, we think, by Shane Bannon, who is kind of the performance director, team principal of what is now Mitchelton Scott. And he seems to, based on what Manuela Fundacion, this charitable organisation from Spain, and the people representing them, which includes Stefano Garzelli, the 2000 Giro winner, we think that he has sold his part. Well, he sold his company, which consists of all of the kind of fixed assets of the team, if you could call them that, the you know, lorries and so forth, and also the riders' contracts. He sold that to Manuela Fundacion, which seems odd that Shane Bannon would do that without, you know, the full approval of Jerry Ryan, who owns effectively the right of the team to participate in races in the World Tour. But that's what seems to have happened. As we speak, they're sort of thrashing out what seems to be a bit of a disagreement. Garzelli and this Manuela Fundacion, they remain confident that it is all going to be sorted out and that Jerry Ryan will eventually relinquish the license and the team will crack on, press on as a new team with that name. We've seen the jersey now, this purple jersey with pink sleeves. The UCI, I've spoken to them about this. They are obviously up to speed with, well, with some of what's going on. They've approved the jersey, although there's a caveat to that. This new jersey has to be changed, apparently, for the Giro d'Italia because of the pink sleeves. They would clash with the pink jersey. Yeah, we don't really know how it's going to proceed from here. I mean, we were sort of scratching our heads when the announcement was made because the businessman behind the Manuela Fundacion doesn't seem to have a big footprint. He's not stratospherically rich, we don't think. We don't fully understand where the money's going to come from. You know, I understand that in the first couple of days after the deal was announced, there was a little bit of sort of confusion in the old Mitchelton Scott organisation about some things that Garzelli and a couple of other people connected with the Manuela Fundacion had said to the press. Things like the team moving its service course to Granada, and they weren't terribly happy with the way some of the communication was happening. But then you know, I've also heard that there's a bit of frustration in the organization now that Jerry Ryan is holding things up, because, you know, it's well publicized, well documented that the riders and staff on the team have been taking big pay cuts for several months now, and also, you know, are unsure of their futures, and they would like the deal to go ahead with a group of people, an organization which seems to be offering them a future with the team. So yeah, we'll see what happens over the next few days, but it does have to be sorted in the next few days because the team is supposed to resume racing at the Vuelta a Burgos, which is coming up at the end of July.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
A huge thank you to iWalker, our title sponsor. And there's lots of information on the iWalker website about how they can help businesses, and how, if you run a business, you can apply for a CIBIL, the Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme, or certainly register your interest in a CIBIL. But there are also lots of stories about businesses that iWalker have helped. And one of the case studies which I came across today was about iWalker customer BAME Recruitment, a company set up by Cynthia Davis. Cynthia has worked in recruitment for over 20 years, and she was determined to break the cycle of employers hiring talent based on where they went to university or their backgrounds instead of their skills and potential. The company has placed hundreds of people in jobs across the UK, and 68% of those people are black or from an ethnic minority. To quote Verna Myers, Cynthia says, "Diversity is like being invited to a party. Inclusion is being asked to dance. Equality and belonging is being on the party planning committee." That's not a quote I'd heard before, but it's very good. Lots of stories like that on iwalker.co.uk. So have a look, especially if you run a small business. And this issue that BAME Recruitment seek to address and rectify is one that we're going to return to later in this podcast, I believe. And as it relates to cycling, professional cycling in particular. Now, chaps, we are doing our press conference. Just before we go to the first question, a couple of bits of housekeeping. We have a new friend special out, don't we? It's a conversation with me and Orla about me. Yeah. Lionel, you've listened. Daniel, you've probably not listened.
Not yet. That's on the list, definitely. It's on the
list. On the list. Wonderful.
Yeah.
You don't get a finer endorsement than that from Daniel, though, do you? Oh.
What are the highlights?
Oh, you'll have to listen.
Come on, three bullet points. Three big revelations. Oh. No?
Well, there aren't really three big revelations, really, either.
Let's, great. You're doing a great job of selling it here. this is available.
It's a very absorbing listen, Daniel, as was your episode, Daniel, as well, which I listened to before our Giro. I felt in about an hour and a half with Richard and about an hour and a quarter with Daniel, I felt like I learned more about the pair of you than I have done in the last 7 years.
So there are some big revelations.
I don't know what that says about you, Lionel, but
I've been listening.
Anyway, we've got another one of these coming out, I think, next week, and that's my chat with Orla about her career. So that's coming out. These are for friends of the podcast. Do sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. And something else coming up in the month of July, when the Tour de France should have been on, is a series called My First Tour de France. And that is, well, as the title suggests, each of us and Francois Tomazo reminiscing in separate episodes about our first Tour de France, whether that be our first tour that we watched, our first tour that we saw in the flesh, our first tour that we worked at or covered in full. So that should be interesting, we hope, for friends of the podcast. And if you want to become a friend, you can do so at thecyclingpodcast.com. Shall we go to the first question?
Hi there, Richard, Lionel and Daniele. It's Matt here from Dedham in the UK, nestled quietly on the border between Essex and Suffolk, where there aren't actually that many hills. I just wanted to say thanks for our Giro. The daily pod and the RGT routes were exactly what I needed to get me through quite a difficult month, with my mum passing away on the 20th of May. The escapism of listening to the pods while trying not to focus on how slowly the kilometres were ticking away on those massive climbs was a real tonic. I especially enjoyed the two Cipollini episodes. One comment though, where's my finisher's medal? Surely there should be some reward for all of us that suffered at the hands of the evil race director, Signor Fibrincini. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you for your message, Matt. That's Matt Lawrence from the Essex-Suffolk border. Our condolences, first of all. Very sorry to hear about your mother passing away. And it's lovely to hear that the podcast and the challenge that we set to ride our Giro, or segments of our Giro, provided some distraction, if nothing else. Daniele Fibrincini, who is still staring half naked at me on my screen, you did set a pretty severe challenge, Daniel, and the least Matt deserves is surely some kind of finisher's medal. What do you say to this?
Well, you were in charge of the
medals.
You were the head of the prize committee, I understood. Anyway, I mean, I heard it was hard. I have to take your word for it. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure it was that severe.
It wasn't that hard sticking out the sunroof of the race director's car, was it?
How about a copy of the Grand Tour Diaries for Matt? There we are, as a prize.
We can do that.
I mean, we can't offer that to everyone who completed our Giro, can we?
Matt, drop us a line if you'd like a copy of the Grand Tour Diaries. If you've already got one, I'm sure our friends at Science and Sport can send you some goodies as well. But yeah, as you say, Lionel, this is not an offer open to everybody who completed our Giro.
We don't want to be clear. Yeah, we don't want to get into difficulties, do we? Just on our Giro, I'm thinking of starting this Saturday, reviving my People's Grand Tour. Do you remember that you mocked it repeatedly years ago?
It didn't catch on because it was ahead of its time, wasn't it?
It was before Strava clubs and things. The idea was that you had to ride every day for 3 weeks, a bit like a Grand Tour. The minimum qualifying ride per day was 1 hour. I'm going to do that. The Tour de Home kicks off on Saturday, Richard. Are you going to take part?
No.
Okay. All right. So peloton of one taking part in the Tour de Home. I'm going to do the sex shop time trial on Saturday, Rich.
It was the Mavic. What was it? Mavic Zap gears of its time. Was it Zap? Their electronic shift.
Exactly.
Or Tektronik. I think they had Zap. Did they have Zap first and then Tektronik? something along those lines. Anyway, poor old Mavic have gone out are going out of business, aren't they? But hopefully to be saved by, among others, Bernardino.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can have these great ideas. I mean, basically, I invented Strava, didn't I? Just with people emailing me how far they'd ridden. I mean, it's not as good as Strava, admittedly. Anyway, let's move on.
Hello, Lionel, Richard, Daniel. This is Luke from Colorado. Over the quarantine, there was a certain kind of unusually loud chorus of riders and ex-riders, including Lance, who aggressively pushed for the rights of the pro peloton and how now was the time for the riders and the union, you know, to really emerge and make significant change. In most labor experiences, there's usually one person, either elected or appointed, who emerges as the person who takes that information, elevates it, and really gets the ball rolling. Why is it in the pro peloton that there's really not one single voice or a leader or a veteran who takes the mantle and charges with it and speaks on behalf of the riders? They seem very fragmented, but yet sort of aligned too, but there doesn't ever seem to be a single leader who advocates for the pro peloton. Perhaps you can give me some insight on that.
Thank you, Luke, from Colorado. Very grateful to you for your question. This has been a bit of a hot topic recently, hasn't it? I mean, Lance Armstrong, that is, the controversial Lance Armstrong, has over the years talked about this quite a lot. I remember him at the Giro in 2009 when he came back, taking a sort of leading role in having the stage in Milan neutralised when it was raining. And certainly he was the sort of personality who could stand up and speak on behalf of the riders. Fabian Cancellara was another one. Bernardino, you mentioned him already, he was another one. Why is it, asks Luke, that there doesn't seem to be anybody, or there aren't many sort of characters like that? And I think the answer is in the Lance Armstrong documentary that we reviewed a couple of weeks ago. The comment that Floyd Landis made about the likes of Armstrong being few and far between in cycling, those very domineering personalities. He said most top bike riders are introverts, and I think there's a lot in that. And there aren't many riders who appear to be have the personality, frankly, the charisma to stand up, really lead their peers. Eno, to me, was the ultimate in that regard. There haven't been many like him.
No, they haven't, Rich. But I think at the moment there is something brewing. There's been this low-level dissatisfaction, or in some cases actually quite explicit dissatisfaction with the CPA, which is kind of the closest thing that Pro Peloton has to a riders' union. It's the Association of Professional Riders. It's got branches in various different countries now. But there has been this dissatisfaction with it. And Andy Hood, our colleague at VeloNews, wrote a story about this a few days ago. There's something brewing there. There's a group that's been brought together by Steph Clement, former Dutch rider, and he's got a sort of coalition of riders, agents and experts in governance together, and I think you'll see them putting some pressure on the CPA in the next few months about various issues, including the whole coronavirus issue. But it occurred to me that it's a bit of a shame at the moment there isn't racing, because I think it's with the Black Lives Matter movement, there'd be a great opportunity there for the riders to come into their own and to make a stand. And you know, at a race, we've seen the riders come together in that fashion on very rare occasions in the past. I remember some fudged sort of demonstrations. At the time it felt quite fudged, but in 2007, wasn't it, the Tour de France, the riders tried to block the start line, and when a group of them were fed up with the sort of constant trickle of dope positive tests and doping scandals. And it felt as though it didn't really have the impact that it should have done at the time. But in hindsight, I think it was actually one sort of sign that things were moving and things were changing in terms of a positive peer pressure that helped professional cycling to emerge from the dire crisis that it was in. And you know, I think the spirit of the moment in football, and how footballers have sort of reacted to the Black Lives Matter moment, and how they have really sort of come together. And, you know, I think a lot of it of their own initiative as well. I think I could see a similar sort of thing happening in cycling, and that really bringing the riders together in a more meaningful way on other issues going forward.
Yeah, Luke uses the word fragmented there, and I think that, you know, often we do find ourselves observing this situation where the race organisers, the team owners and the riders, you know, really they're all on the same side. They should all be on the same side, but often they're kind of divided up a little bit, and the riders among the most precarious people in the sport. I mean, I think there's very few riders who have contracts longer than a couple of years, and you would think that they would have greater strength as a collective than being individual, but there's never really been a great tradition of a sort of union in professional cycling, whereas in American sports often, you know, there's a tradition of collective bargaining, certainly in the National Football League, which basically means that the players all know, you know, where they stand, and they have a negotiation between the players and the league owners and the team owners to try to look out for the interests of the players over not just the short term but the longer term. It's far from perfect, I gather, because, you know, not all, you know, still the best paid players, you know, get the best deal. But there is much more of a kind of sense that they're all on the same side. And cycling has probably been just that. It's just probably been too small, rather than thinking that they could all grow and strengthen their positions by unifying and speaking with one voice. There's never really been, certainly in the time I've been covering the sport, I mean, the CPA's voice has never been a particularly dominant one, has it? It's you know, sends out the odd press release, but it doesn't feel like it's a movement that all of the riders are behind and that all of the riders are engaged with.
Hello chaps, this is Thomas calling from Sweden, long time listener of the podcast and friend of the podcast as well. Thanks a lot for keeping my cycling mood high during these lockdown times. Really great content you've put out there. Thanks a lot. As I said, I live in Sweden, but I'm born and raised in Denmark, and was thrilled to see Mads Pedersen win the World Championship last year. For the pronunciation police, it is Pedersen for the last name. I had been looking forward to see him wear the rainbow jersey during the entire season, but especially during the couple classics this spring, and that obviously didn't happen, and it probably won't happen this fall unless he wins the World Championship once again in Switzerland. So I guess my question is, how do you think we will look back on Mads Pedersen's run, or the lack of run, as world champion in a few years from now?
Well, thanks for your question, Thomas. You live in Sweden, but you were born in Denmark. Obviously interested in Mads Pedersen, the world champion, who has not had many opportunities to wear his rainbow jersey this year. When he did wear it at the start of the year, I thought we were going to see a really good season from him. It looked like he was... It's hard to tell, though, isn't it? Because you're more aware of it anyway. I remember... Sorry, I'm going on a tangent here, but I remember a piece you wrote about a few years ago about the sort of Moneyball idea in cycling, Daniel, in the first cycling anthology, I think. And you talked about how in football, players with blonde hair could be valued higher just because they tend to be more noticeable, and they catch the eye more. You know, when you watch a bike race, it's hard to tell whether you're impressed by the way someone like Pedersen, who's quite a big guy as well as riding, or whether you just notice his rainbow jersey more. But certainly in the sort of opening weekend and then Paris-Nice, he was very visible indeed and doing a lot of work for his team, even going back to Tour Down Under too. And it looked to me like he was shaping up well for the classics. We will never now know, of course, but it's unlucky for him, isn't it, to not have had the full season thus far riding in the World Champions jersey.
Yes, Rich, and we all have heard and have talked in the past about the curse of the rainbow jersey, but he wouldn't be the first rider whose rainbow jersey doesn't seem set to get much action. Luc Leblanc in 1995 had a pretty poor next season, partly because his team Le Groupement collapsed halfway through the season, didn't wear it much. Oscar Freire, when he won the Rainbow jersey for the first time, so he won it in 1999, in the 2000 season, he spent a lot of time on the sidelines through injury. There have been others, haven't there, Napoli?
Well, Stephen Roach in 88 as well.
This is the first time that a rider has been denied the opportunity to wear the rainbow jersey by a global pandemic, to be fair. One question we've been asked on Twitter is, would we support the notion that the World Championships, which are going to be held the week after the Tour de France finishes, so we're talking about towards the end of September, would we back a motion that would allow the new world champion and Mads Pedersen to both wear the rainbow jersey next year and allow Pedersen to have the honour that he so richly deserved and earned by winning in Yorkshire? I mean, he's been denied through no fault of his own. It's not like he's had an injury or an illness. He's not been able to race because the races haven't been on. So could have two rainbow jerseys. I can see you're looking sceptical at that idea, Richard. No? Is it just bad luck?
Not in favour of that. Yeah, just I think the beauty of the rainbow jersey is there's only one, and there's a purity to that. Which,
but there's not only one, is there? There's a time trial one, there's track ones, there's some cyclocross.
Yeah, but there's only
one
in any one race. You don't get, in any one race, there's only one. You don't get to wear your time trial world champions jersey in a road race. You don't get to wear your road race world champion jersey in a time trial. So, that uniqueness has to be preserved, I think. Sorry, Mads.
It can always buy one napalm on the internet and just wear it.
Bernardino wouldn't like that, would he?
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
A big thank you to Science in Sport, our longest running sponsor, and we're very grateful to them for their continuing support, and to you as well. They are offering 25% off at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. I'm almost through my two-person supply of energy bakes, the sort of little mini cakes that are a substitute for energy bars, and I'm almost through them, Lionel. That was a consignment for me and you, which I kept, but I've been doing so much cycling that I've been wolfing them down. I did a bike ride last week with Ned Bolting, television's Ned Bolting, and we went out to Box Hill, and we thought the cafe at the top might be open, and he was a bit peckish, Ned, and he was looking forward to getting a snack at the top. Unfortunately, it was closed. And he was very reluctant to take my energy bake, but he did, and he said it was all right. So there is an endorsement, Science of Sport. If you want to put that on the wrapper somewhere, it got him through. It got him to the finish. So there you go. The food of champions. But yeah,
who won between you and Ned?
Well, he messaged me on Sunday while we were watching the Slovenian National Road Race Championship to say that Pog and Rog's slugfest on the climb is very similar, very, very reminiscent of our duel on Box Hill the previous week. It was a bit of a scoring draw, but we really did. We went at each other, I have to say.
Both extremely competitive.
There wasn't a lot of talking going up there.
I've seen Ned play pétanque, and it was frightening how competitive he was.
I think, as you know, Daniel, I'm not very competitive at all, so I was pretty relaxed about the whole thing, but surprised he didn't drop me. Anyway, shall we hear from another listener?
Hello, chaps. John McGowan, long-term friend of the podcast, and in this context, a clinical psychologist. Really, really interesting discussion about Lance Armstrong. And what's more, I think I'm struck by just how fascinated we still are by him. And I've been trying to work out why. I mean, in one sense, he's neither a David Miller, a repentant doper, nor an Alexander Vinokourov, a kind of pantomime villain. So what's the fascination? Daniel said it's the doping, but I think it's more than that. It's something about the interaction of the doping, him kind of trashing his own brand, this heroic brand, and undermining it. That's very unlike others. And he hasn't really ended up embracing either of these poles at the end. Is doping as bad? I don't think it is necessarily in the great scheme of things. But I think we're trying to still work out the hurt that he caused for asking people to believe. And I wonder if we're still trying to go over that, even all these years later.
So that was John McGowan on Lance. Interesting to hear his his thoughts. A thought more than a question, really, but very interesting. And I guess, you know, further evidence of how Armstrong continues to fascinate. And it doesn't fascinate everybody. We reviewed the film a couple of weeks ago. That was an episode that drew a lot of reaction from people, and a lot of people listened to it, actually. What does surprise me is people having opinions about the film who haven't watched it. I've been aware of quite a lot of that. That seems odd to me. And people who say they're not interested in Armstrong when clearly they are interested in Armstrong. There's a bit of that. But yeah, that was an interesting point from John. I'm not sure there was a question there, but it was fascinating to hear his take on the Armstrong enigma. Can we call him an enigma?
Hi, Roger Taylor from Hertfordshire, a friend of the podcast. I really enjoyed Lionel's conversation with Yanni Brekovic earlier this year. It was brave and honest and insightful. In particular, the exploration of Yanni's disordered eating and his bulimia feels really important. In a sport that sometimes attracts and fosters an obsessive approach, the incessant pursuit of improve watts per kilogram can lead to an unhealthy relationship with food and potentially distort body image. Even in the world of club cycling and amateur racing, the old-time machismo of doing hard rides on nothing more than a bottle of water can be all too persuasive for younger, more suggestible riders. So to my question, how much of a problem do you think this is in the male and female pro ranks, and what can be done about it?
Thank you for your question, Roger. I actually met Roger at the Vuelta last year down near Calpe. I can't remember which morning it was. Exactly where we were, but we were on that coast. It felt like we were on that coast for quite a long time anyway, but we were on that coast and had a bit of a chat. It's an interesting question. I'm glad you enjoyed the Friends of the Podcast episode with Yanni Brekovic, which was, well, it was my last trip out of the country before lockdown, because that was a trip that I did in February. And
you might have been stuck there, Lionel, and if you had been, you'd have been able to cover the Slovenian national road race for us.
I could have run alongside with my phone, filming.
Charging people €5.
€4.50, you know, businessman, eh? Businessman. Anyway, a serious question from Roger. And yes, I kind of was aware, you know, Yanni Brekovic talked so openly about his own experiences and his own battle with disordered eating, which then became an eating disorder. And I take the point that, you know, it was in a Friends of the Podcast episode, which inexplicably not everyone signs up as a friend of the podcast. Only a percentage of our listeners do. And it's a subject that may have some interest or relevance to young riders, old riders, any riders out there who are experiencing a similar thing. So I called Yanni last week and just asked him the question about his own experiences.
In my case, I had nobody to talk to. And I think that if teams had people who are trained in eating disorders or psychology, it would already be a lot. Riders could talk with them openly without being worried of those doctors or psychologists talking about riders' problems with the staff, the management, which is the case now. Because in today's times, if you talk with a team doctor about a particular problem, that doctor will almost certainly tell that either DS or team manager, and that's why nobody wants to talk to doctors today. The more we talk about it, the easier it is to talk about it. We all know that it is present in cycling, but nobody wants to talk about it because immediately it makes you different and weak, and nobody wants to be weak.
Just remind me of your situation and how you realize that it wasn't just a disordered relationship or a dysfunctional relationship with food, but that it had become a real problem.
My problem started long, long ago. I think that the most dangerous period for a rider is being stepping into under 23 ranks, because there's still sort of amateur, semi-professional teams, and everybody does something extreme. A new rider observes, of course, and he wants to do the same. And if you go too far, it quickly becomes a disordered eating and then an eating disorder. And before you realize you have a problem and then you don't know how to get out. And of course you don't want to talk about it with nobody. And it stays with you forever. You can educate yourself, you can try to fix it yourself, but for an eating disorder, you need somebody else to talk to and to guide you through, and somebody who you can trust everything and you're comfortable talking with.
So who was that for you?
There was one person I started to talk with, and of course my family, but I love my spouse, but she's not trained in this. But already talking with her about it was a really big relief. That's how you start it. I mean, you start talking with your closest. Then you realize you really need to do something about it. And then you look for somebody else who's trained in these things and you try to solve it. It's not an easy process. I'm not going to say it's like today I have an eating disorder, tomorrow I'm good. It's a really long process. There's going to be relapses. There's going to be bad things happening. But as long as you try to go back on normal, you're doing well.
I don't really know enough about this, but so I'm, correct me if this is wrong or whether this is not something that you think from your experience. But is it something that if somebody notices it early and can prevent disordered eating becoming an eating disorder, or can stop before it becomes a serious pattern, a regular pattern of behavior, is it something that you can intervene early and really recover sooner rather
absolutely.
Than
as soon as you approach it, as soon as you realize you have a problem, even if it's just a disordered eating, even if you're just like obsessing with food every day, but you don't have full-blown eating disorder, if you realize that you have a problem and you start working on it, it's going to be much easier process to get well again than suffering from an eating disorder for 5-10 years. By then, it became your lifestyle, and your life is focused only about food and eating and what you're going to eat and planning. That makes it much harder to solve it.
And of course, it can be, there's a whole range of these conditions. In your case, it was bulimia, but it could be people denying themselves enough food. There are different types of disordered eating and eating disorder, aren't there? So somebody working with a particularly a young rider or any rider, really, what are the signs that a coach or a team manager should be looking out for? What would be the best way to try to intervene if they thought there was a problem developing?
With anorexia, you can see it immediately because person will lose a lot of weight and will be at extremely low weight. So you can see it, and you can see what he eats and how much he eats. But with bulimia, it's a little bit harder because he can or she can be really skinny and light, but it's not always the case. You can be just a normal weight. That person will not eat too little or too much around other people. So it's really, really hard to recognize because in my case, I was really good at hiding it. I never eat too little when I was around other people or too much. But sometimes there were extremes. I would eat very little or huge amounts of food. And I think during my career, some people were suspecting there was something wrong with me, but nobody really wanted to talk about it because they didn't know how to talk and how to approach me. Because once you approach a rider and talk to him about an eating disorder, you're suspecting that there's something wrong with him. But for him, it's even harder because he'll be lying to you. Almost for sure, because you'll never say to your sports director, yes, I have a problem and I didn't know how to cope with it. You'll always lie. And from that point on, it's even harder to work with that person because you know you lie to him and you're always lying to him and you cannot be honest with him anymore. That's the hard part.
So if there's anyone listening who recognizes some of this for themselves, what would your first bit of advice be to go and talk to somebody who's medically trained to who can help with the situation?
Yeah, that's the right approach. But in other case, if he or she is a really good friend of yours, it might be good to talk to him about the problem, and there should be no judging. You should be respectful. If he denies it, you don't want to push it, because it's going to make things even worse.
But you can come through the other side and get the situation under control.
Absolutely. That's not a thing that's going to stay with you for the rest of your life. And you have to realize that with these kinds of eating behaviors, you're doing a lot of harm to your body and most likely your career. It might be okay for a year or two, but then the real effect's gonna show up, and things are not gonna be well.
Because in the equation of watts per kilogram, the watts need to be there, and if you're not eating properly, exactly, and looking after yourself, that will suffer.
Exactly. You might be really, really skinny, really low weight, but watts are not there. So at the end of the day, watts per kilo are not what you think they would be. So sooner or later, it's not going to work anymore for you. So it's not a good thing, honestly. It's not a way to live or to race or to have a career, because there's also other things that affect your body. And there's muscle mass, there's bone density, there's osteoporosis. And there's so many bad things that follows this diet or eating disorder that it's not really worth it. Honestly, everybody knows that it's not the right way, but they don't know how to approach it and how to fix it.
So thank you to Jani Brekovic for talking about a deeply personal subject so openly, not once but twice. Really appreciate that. And hopefully, well, if anyone is struggling with those kind of issues, they can follow his advice and seek help from somebody that they trust. Brekovic rode the Slovenian Championships at the weekend, finished fourth in the road race. Did you see him the moment he got dropped? Was he the fourth last rider to get dropped, just missing out on the podium? But a good result for Brekovic, and I guess his next race will be... well, what will they do? Adria Mobil, the Slovenian team. They might get a ride in the Tour Poland or something like that, perhaps.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet interrupting this week's episode to remind me to tell you that it is supported by Babbel, the new and very effective way to learn a foreign language.
Funny you should say that, Rich. Babbel is exactly what I do when I'm trying to speak a foreign language. Although this might surprise you, I did French at A-level.
You're right, that does surprise me. Well, listen, Daniel is our linguist, and it's fair to say that you and I, Lionel, remain very much on his wheel when we're in France, Spain or Italy, Germany too, if we're there, where we spend a lot of time in these countries covering the major bike races.
Yeah, I'm very envious of Daniel's ease with foreign languages, and I feel like I've built up a bit of a mental block over the years. But Rich, you speak a fair bit of French.
A fair bit, that's very kind. Sadly, not as much as my 3-year-old.
Has he been using Babbel already?
Well, he's fluent in Babbel, absolutely. Yeah. But he's also, he's fluent in as fluent as a 3-year-old can be in French and English, which is impressive.
Very envious, very envious. But for the rest of us who find foreign languages a bit more of a, well, I find them a bit of a hill to get over. And I keep trying different things. And, well, Babbel, how does it work? It teaches you through real life conversations, and you learn through interactive dialogues. Speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent, which is definitely something that I need to work on.
Yeah, I've been doing it for a few days now. I signed up for 15-minute a day lessons, which doesn't sound like much, and it isn't, and that's what makes it quite easy. But it's quite fun as well, and it's very interactive. You can choose from 14 different languages, and the lessons have been lovingly created by over 100 language experts, real people, not machines. I've been brushing up on my French, as I mentioned, with my daily lessons. What about you, Lionel? Have you signed up as well?
I have, yeah. I'm trying to train my brain the same way I try to get fit through cycling, just through repetition and not trying to do too much and sort of burning out. So I've set between 15 and 30 minutes a day. I'm actually doing Italian because I've been doing a couple of different courses that have got me a certain way, but I think Babbel is the one to get me over the line. So I'm going to carry on and see how I get on.
Well, try Babbel today. Just go to babbel.co.uk or download the app for free. That's Babbel, BABBEL.co.uk, or download the app to try for free. Babbel, learn a new language and make it your own.
I'm only doing Italian because I just want to make this Lionel Learns Italian feature that keeps threatening to rear its head during our Giro coverage. I want to just put it to bed and never have to deal with Daniel looking at me in a funny way again.
What's Italian for put it to bed?
Haven't got to that bit yet.
Well, Daniel, you mentioned earlier Black Lives Matter and how some of the sporting world, you know, football in particular, has really embraced that and responded to it extremely well. Cycling obviously hasn't had the opportunity, but one inescapable fact is that professional cycling is an overwhelmingly white sport. And this is something that we've had a bit of correspondence on. We've got one question that relates to that, which we'll hear from in a minute. It's a subject we've wanted to address and sort of wrestled with how to best address it as three white men ourselves. It clearly is an issue in cycling, but to fully understand it, we thought we'd speak to a friend of ours, Matt Rabin, who is a chiropractor. He's been on the podcast quite a few times before. Matt is black. He is from London. He works for EF Pro Cycling. He's worked in cycling for a long time, about 15 years, and at the World Tour, I guess 10 years or so, at least 10 years, actually. So Matt's perspective, we thought, would be very interesting to hear. So I spoke to him earlier today, and we'll hear his thoughts on the subject in a moment or two. But I'll just read one bit of an email that we got, which addresses some of these points. This email came in from Toby Coombs, and he basically asks us to use our platform through the podcast to raise the voices of Black British cyclists and to help highlight the reasons why, despite cycling's national diversity, there are so few Black professional cyclists in the UK and across the world. Following the death of George Floyd, Black people in the US and UK are asking white people like myself to listen and read about the prejudices and hostilities Black people face and to recognise how we can do more to increase equality and justice. Cycling is a perfect example of the insidious nature of racial inequity. Not all of cycling's heroes are white, not all of its history is white, yet so many of the stories we hear and the images we see are of white people. There are many reasons for this, but it is without doubt in part due to prejudice. So that was Toby Coombs, a listener and friend of the podcast. And we'll hear a little bit now from another listener, Ted Berkowitz, and then go straight into my interview with Matt Rabin.
Hey, Richard, Daniel, and Lionel. It's Ted Berkowitz, friend of the podcast, Sheltering in Place, outside of New York City. Williams Brothers and the Legion of LA cycling team, who now have sort of risen to the forefront in light of the racial and social injustice that has been highlighted in the cycling industry over the past several weeks. Again, thank you so much, and hope you guys are safe.
Well, Matt, let's start at the beginning. I mean, why do you think there are so few Black professional riders?
It's a difficult one to answer, but I would say that if you look at the Pro Peloton, it's probably not blessed with diversity from an ethnicity perspective. There's lots of different nations involved, but there's not that many Black or minority riders in it. So if you're a young Black potential athlete, you're not really seeing people in pro cycling that kind of look like you, and therefore that might be one of the reasons that you're not going to be potentially drawn towards it. I'm not saying your heroes have to particularly look like you, but then this, you know, in all walks of life there tends to be a reflection on all other walks of life. And you know, if you're a young Black kid and you're athletic and you want to get into some sort of want to be a pro sportsman, I just don't know if cycling would be the first one that you'd be drawn to. It's probably not the first one you'd be exposed to from a young age, unless you had sort of a family member who was you know, pushing you in that direction, or friends that took you along to it. So I think it's more, you know, it's about exposure. It's probably about opportunity, because a lot of the kit for cycling is, you know, is not cheap. And that's not to say that, you know, if you're black, therefore you're poor. But the point is, if you're a minority trying to get into a minority sport, the chances of that happening are probably, you know, more stretched.
Well, you as a kid in London, as a teenager in London, you went to school with Bradley Wiggins, of course. You know, what sports were you into, and what drew you to them? Can you remember what, you know, what was the pull factor?
The cool factor was, like, you know, football was the sport, because it was at a time when we had four channels. You had Match of the Day on a Saturday. You had, you know, one or two games a week. But, you know, living in London, where myself and where Bradley grew up, you know, it was QPR, it was Tottenham, it was Arsenal, it was Chelsea. Those are your sort of local teams. That was the stuff you read in the sports pages. You'd read about football, you'd read about probably a little bit of rugby. And then after that, it was kind of falling into what might be deemed lesser known sports. So, you know, from my perspective, even though I went to school with Brad, and, you know, he's quite open, and he said that he used to sort of sneak off and do his own thing and sneak out the back of his estate with his kit on and not really tell anybody about it. I just wasn't really aware at a young age that professional cycling was probably even a thing.
You work in professional cycling now. What was that like to come into? Because there are very few riders who are non-white, but there are also, that's mirrored in the staff, you know, in all the people that work in professional cycling too. So what was it like for you to come into that world?
Okay, I grew up in central London, but then we moved to the South Coast when I was about 11 or 12. So I moved to a school where I was probably one of only two or three black kids out of 1,000. So, you know, being a minority in that situation, it never... going into cycling, there's probably, you know, more than two or three black people per 1,000 in cycling. So for me, it wasn't that difficult a transition. I've never really judged people by the color of their skin or looked at myself as necessarily different because of that. So for me, the transition was, I mean, it was transition, what does that mean? I mean, for me, working in pro cycling, it was never really an issue going into that. You know, there were one or two comments that I had, you know, that I wouldn't put down as racist anyway, but there are one or two things that you sort of hear along the way that, you know, that are questionable, but I wouldn't put them down as racism.
Well, I was going to ask you if you had experienced racism. I mean, you work in football as well. I mean, football's done quite a lot to try and confront it and challenge it, and it's had a historic problem. Cycling perhaps hasn't, if only because there have been so few black riders, but there have been one or two incidents. We might touch on them. But have you experienced any racism at all in cycling?
I had a funny incident. The very first time I ever came to the team was at Paris Nice in 2008, and I'd been going backwards and forwards with the team doc at the time about, you know, we'd been chatting, and, you know, I was a chiropractor, and we'd spoken on the phone, and we'd emailed each other, and basically when we got to the race, it was the first time I met him, and the first thing he said to me was, "Oh, nobody told me you were black," and I was like, That's a strange thing to say, but you know, we kind of like laughed about it. But in hindsight, that's an obscure thing to say. I mean, what's that got to do with anything? You know what I mean? But after that, no, I can honestly say I haven't really been subjected to any racism from a personal level. I've heard of, you know, people have told me that this person or that person, be wary of them because they do have racist connotations, but. I'm kind of like one of those people that I judge a book, but I don't judge a book by its cover, but I take people at face value. So if someone is going to do something or say something to me, then that's the time that I'd probably address that, because otherwise there's a lot of hearsay and sort of talk and conjecture. And I mean, I haven't got time. Who's got time to deal with rumors? You know what I mean? You can only deal with the facts as they're sort of exposed to you.
I mean, you came into the sport as a, you know, a highly qualified, experienced, skilled, you know, member of staff. What do you imagine it would be like for a young black kid starting out in a World Tour team and encountering that world? Can you sort of put yourself in their shoes?
You mean as a pro?
Yeah, as a rider.
I can probably imagine it would be pretty difficult, to be honest with you. I mean, if you look at the, you know, I look around the peloton now, you know, being black myself, I'm aware of there's a few, you know, one of the things I realised when I went, the first event I ever did was I did the Track Worlds in 2006, and, you know, Gregory Bourges was there, and he stands out because he's one of the few black riders. So when you see it, you go, oh, there are black people involved in the sport, and same thing now in a pro peloton. You know, there was Daniel Tekle-Hylma for a little while, Kevin Reza's obviously about, and then there's a few other, you know, Eritrean riders who you kind of spot about the place, but you do notice them because they are, you know, in the minority. And if you're that coming into a sport which has got like a, you know, a global diversity to its nature, and you've got Europeans, Northern Europeans, you've got Southern Europeans, you've got North Americans, you've got South Americans, you know, Australians, Brits. There's a big sort of melting pot of different riders. If you are a young black rider coming into that, depending probably which team you're in, or depending what races you go to, yeah, I can imagine it wouldn't be an easy thing to necessarily integrate yourself with without being the subject of some racial slurs in some capacity, if we're being honest.
Some form of prejudice or discrimination, or being made to be aware of your difference, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, if you're Tiger Woods playing golf, even, you know, he was one of the few, right? And he was the best in this sport, but I'm sure he even experienced it in some level. So if you're a young kid in cycling and you're not at Peter Sagan's level, or you're not at, I don't know, Chris Froome's level, then I'm sure the journey to become that, you're going to experience some nature of it, I would imagine.
I mentioned it briefly, but there have been a couple of racist incidents or allegations, and one that was punished, not perhaps appropriately, involving Jenny Moscon and Kevin Reza a few years ago now. You're a pretty easygoing guy, but that, speaking to you at the time and since, that was an incident that did upset you, I would say. I mean, can you describe how it made you feel, and whether it was the racist aspect of it that really kind of got you? I imagine it was, but can you describe your sort of emotions around that?
When I sort of read that, it was disappointing on many levels. First of all, the action itself, as it happened, you know, I can only imagine, like, you know, Kevin Reza, who I don't know, you know, is a minority in a sport as a European. So it's not as if he's an, you know, of Eritrean descent and he's grown up around loads of black cyclists. I don't imagine, maybe he has, being the only black guy on that team at that race in that environment, whereby Moscon allegedly was subjected into a racial slur, probably in and around some of his peers. I can only imagine what he must have felt. But from a personal perspective, when I heard that and how it sort of played out, I mean, yeah, it made my blood boil, if I'm honest, because I think that, you know, in today's society, there is no place for it. And even more, going more further than that, my personal opinion is the punishment that was dished out is really deplorable. Because if you look at, you know, this at the time, Moscon is riding for Team Sky, which is a massive British media company. You know, in the UK, we all watch football on Sky, and it's quite ironic at the moment because every single presenter on Sky Sports is wearing a Black Lives Matter badge, yet one of their employees, only like 2 or 3 years ago, one of their staff, if you like, openly, subjectively, racially abused, let's say it like that, which is what he was found guilty of, racially abused a fellow rider. And the punishment was, what was it, 6 weeks off, 6 weeks suspension, whatever that means. We don't know. We don't know if that means he went without pay, but he went without racing. But then his suspension was lifted a few days before, again, allegedly what was going to be his next race on the calendar. I mean, how they sort of, how that was fudged and came out is just revolting, if you ask me. And I thought that at the time, and the more I think about it since, it's just, especially given the light of what's happened, it's just, I don't think it's right. I also don't think it's personally correct that the UCI didn't really get involved. I mean, the sports governing body didn't get involved for something of that nature. I genuinely salute, who was the writer? Was it Reichenbach, who basically called him out as a bully openly on Twitter, which basically got the whole ball rolling? Because we don't know if this hadn't come out like that, if anything would have ever happened about it. You know what I mean? Like, this incident and the one that there was another alleged one a couple of years before that. These are just the two that we know about. Mm. And I'm not saying he's ever experienced any more, but what are the chances that only two times that he's been racially abused within the sport that we've heard about? I just think that's quite, you know, that the chances of that are quite slim. Okay, the UCI not doing anything, I don't think that's right. But equally, you have to ask yourself the question, if he wasn't such a talented rider, Moscon, would the punishment have been harsher? Again, we don't know. What has sending him on a diversity course, I don't know, you know, got to do with anything? Sending him on a why racism is bad course. Why does he need to know about, you know, whatever other elements diversity includes, disabilities or other other minorities? Yes, those are important, but that's not the crime that he got sort of accused of, if you like. But then again, you know, should we be surprised because that same rider has been demonstrated to be allegedly forced to crash a little while after that? He's been demonstrated to be a cheat by holding onto the car at the World Championships. So should we expect a leopard to change their spots? I mean, I don't think it's possible to sort of on one hand talk about all these things that we're trying to do, and on the other hand, this event that you're describing, this didn't happen 10 years ago. This didn't happen 15 years ago. And to be fair to Kevin Reza, like everything that I've read that he's described about it, he sort of said, look, you know, he's held his head up very high about it, and he said, I don't want to be the, you know, the poster boy for anti-racism. And I get that from his perspective, but, you know, because if I was a, you know, when I was a kid growing up in where I grew up as one of only two black kids in 1,000, I wouldn't want to be the poster boy for anti-racism. It's like, no, I've got to get my head down and crack on and do what I need to do. So I do think that the punishment, in my opinion, didn't fit the crime. I think it's ironic now that the company that Lee sponsored at that time is now so vehemently talking about Black Lives Matter. The conversation's moved on, times change, things move on, so it's great that they are doing that. If that same situation happened, you know, the next race, I think that the good news is, I think the punishment would be a lot greater. I would imagine the UCI would get involved, and I don't think the team in question could get away with such a soft punishment.
Finally, Matt, what do you think cycling could do to increase the diversity?
There's many things that can be done. I think at the moment, like, what we're seeing across the world, aside from this sort of, you know, pandemic that we're dealing with, we're seeing what feels a little bit more like a movement, I would say, than a kind of moment. You know what I mean? So, like, historically speaking, they've talked about what can it be done. I mean, even the fact you're having this conversation with me now, you know, we've known each other a very long time, but it's never really felt pertinent for us to have this conversation. And I think that, you know, the fact that the story is progressing is part of that process of, you know, of improvement. Hopefully there can be more done potentially. I think that some of the things that like Dimension Data's are doing in Africa, the fact that there is an African team, that sort of drawn in another subset of riders and given those opportunities. And, you know, the stories I hear about Daniel Tekle-Hymen, when he won the polka dot jersey for a day, you know, he went back home and he was like a hero. The tide is slowly turning. On the other side, you know, there's got to be a want and a desire, because getting in, I think tokenism, I'm not necessarily a big fan of tokenism for tokenism's sake. I think people have to be good enough, and they have to be driven enough, and they have to be diligent enough, and they have to want it enough to get to that level. And if all things are met and all things are equal, then hopefully we'll see even more diversity. I mean, even if you look at the South American and Colombian riders, there's a lot more Colombian riders now in the peloton, where 20, 30 years ago, which is before my time in cycling, that was like more of the, might be deemed as more of the unusual, but now it's kind of more, seems more of the norm. Other things teams could do, I mean, we had a pretty incredible email from our president, Mary Wittenberg, a couple of weeks ago, which basically was like the team off their own bat sent an email to, you know, all of our staff, to saying, hey guys, you know, we're aware of this, there's this Black Lives Matter movement, and we just wanted to share with you some resources and some information that we've kind of pulled together to give you some idea, and here's some things we want to try and do, and here's some things we think you should read. And I think that, you know, the fact that an organization, through no particular prompting, could go off and do that, and some of the resources that they sent, I'm like, wow, there's some pretty good information in there. I mean, that, so it's all about this sharing of information. It's about growing your mind. You know, like the color of your skin or the amount of melanin you have in your skin should have no impact on your ability to perform any task, be it a professional rider, if you want to be a cyclist, a doctor or a lawyer, whatever it might be. So I think that, yes, all things are not equal, but I think that today what we're seeing with this situation, and I'm not saying that just because Black Lives Matter everything else doesn't, that's not the situation that we're talking about, that's not the conversation that's being had. We're just sort of highlighting across the board, as you're saying, that, you know, could there be more diversity in the peloton? Probably yes. Would it be a better place for it? You'd probably think possibly. I don't know. I mean, I imagine, from a personal perspective, I think the more diverse, even from a cognitive diversity perspective, different thought processes, different approaches, different ideas, different talent pools as well. So the more we can pull together for the global good of the sport, you know, that we love, that can only be a good thing.
It was interesting to hear Matt Raban, of course. He is a chiropractor. He works in football as well, but he's worked in cycling and at the very highest level for a long time. And, you know, it's not just an issue with the lack of black riders. There are very few black people working in professional cycling, you know, on team staff and so on. He mentioned that. I mean, he mentioned a few things there. He is quite a laid-back guy, Matt, and he doesn't get exercised or angry about many things. But I think his frustration at the Jenny Moscon affair from a couple of years ago came across pretty strongly, as it has done in the past when I've spoken to him about it. But he said a few things. I mean, one of the most pertinent is probably the issue of role models. You know, if we're talking about why are there so few black professional cyclists, one issue may well be role models, that young black kids don't see other black people doing the sport and therefore find it maybe harder to relate to or to see a pathway into professional cycling. That seems valid to me. It's not to excuse the sport at all. And certainly in racially diverse countries like Britain, the US, and France, you know, you look at the French football team and it's pretty mixed. It is, most of all in France, it's pretty amazing that there haven't been more black professional riders.
Yes, Rich, and we heard in Toby's question there, you know, he mentioned how international cycling is or has become. I think, you know, it's worth just reminding ourselves how recent a development that is. You know, there have been 70 winners of the Tour de France to date, and the biggest race in the sport. Three of them have come from outside of Europe. There hasn't been a winner. The biggest one-day race in the sport is the Tour of Flanders. There hasn't been a non-European Tour of Flanders winner. So that's just to kind of underline how European, how Eurocentric cycling has been. And, you know, if you look at the sort of demographic figures of how white Europe has been and how white Europe still is, 0.08 of the European percent of the European population was black in 2018. That's, you know, figures based on censuses 2018. So France, it has the highest proportion, highest percentage of black people in its population, 8.43%. And you see, you know, a very high representation of black people in sports where, you know, there aren't the same socioeconomic barriers that there are in cycling. And I think, you know, the one thing that I keep coming back to over the last couple of weeks thinking about this issue is just how exclusive and how elitist cycling is. And I think that we take that for granted and we don't really realize that. Just today I looked at a few articles online and, you know, sort of lists of you know, the 10 best bikes to buy, the 10 best cycling shoes and the 10 best entry level shoes. And, you know, even there in a list of 10, you know, the average price of the best entry level shoes being recommended was sort of £50. And it's quite hard to get out of your front gate on a bike nowadays without spending, you know, upward of £500 or £1,000, I would suggest. And, you know, Matt said it's a mistake to, not all black people are poor, but the figures are, and the sort of disparity, which is the result of decades and centuries, really, of sort of persecution and discrimination. Discrepancy is enormous, with the wage gap. And there's no doubt that economically, you know, black people have been discriminated against. And I think that is the biggest barrier. It's the biggest barrier that I see. And you know, when I think about the next sort of 5 years and 10 years and, you know, the things that we and other people in the cycling industry will do and can do to improve the situation, I think that the organisation or the entity that will have, that will offer the most opportunities and will contribute most to opening up cycling will be something or someone like Decathlon, the sports, you know, it's well documented that I love Decathlon, but you know, it's very difficult to get affordable cycling equipment, and that is one place that is a bit of an oasis, and that's vital. I mean, the sports in which there is a lot more equality are the sports where there aren't those barriers. You know, you look at football, you need a ball to play football. Running, athletics, you need a pair of running shoes. You know, basketball, Matt mentioned. Boxing is another one historically. I see that as a huge issue.
I think you're right about accessibility, Daniel, but also the peloton has to be an inclusive place once black riders get into it. And, you know, there have been incidents of allegations, certainly, and in some cases confirmed incidents of riders being racially abused. And the reaction hasn't always been appropriate, has it? I mean, when you think back to Jenny Moscon using really inappropriate and unacceptable language to Kevin Reza, the reaction to that from the top down was really lacking, wasn't it? And, you know, Matt alluded to it. But really, the UCI kind of absolving itself of responsibility and sort of letting Team Sky, as they were at the time, look after the situation themselves. And, you know, in the guise of kind of education, you know, education is undoubtedly an important part of it, but there has to be something from the top down to ensure that black riders are not facing something that their white counterparts do not have to deal with on a daily basis, you know, or run the risk of having to come up against and confront.
Yes, Napa, I think you're absolutely right about the UCI. In that instance, and I think, you know, I'm glad that Matt mentioned this, Sebastian Reichenbach deserves a lot of credit. He was the rider who blew the whistle on that occasion. I think one of the most disappointing things from my point of view in that incident was Moscon's attitude, having served the ban, and I think he was sent, Ineos or Sky said at the time that he went on a race awareness course, but he was pretty reluctant to answer questions about the incident after that, and there wasn't a whole lot of transparency about what the course and what the process he'd been through sort of consisted of. Because, you know, I mean, over the last couple of weeks, a lot of us and a lot of our friends and a lot of our peers have said they need to learn more and, you know, need to read more. So it would be hypocritical of us to say that, you know, it's one strike and you're out and there should be absolutely zero tolerance. You know, Gianni Moscon, I think it was mentioned at the time, he's from an area of Italy where there's very little immigration. Give him the benefit of the doubt, say, look, you know, this is not acceptable, but we're not going to ruin your career. You know, you can be reintegrated into the peloton. But for him to come back then and not to really manifest too much contrition was disappointing, very disappointing. And, you know, certainly I think that was pretty much the first incident, really, the first public incident in professional cycling. Going forward, any further incidents really should be treated with no tolerance. But the UCI didn't really lay a marker down there, and should have done, and it was a missed opportunity.
I suppose a more general point from my point of view is that, you know, covering cycling, this is not an issue we've had to address too many times, although I like to think that we dealt with it pretty well and were pretty clear about what we thought about the Moscon incident when it happened. But I worked on a couple of books where this was a bigger issue, concerning athletics, the dirtiest race in history, about the 1988 Olympic 100 metre final, and a book about the Jamaican sprinting phenomenon. And when I went back through the archives and the writing in the 80s, the overt racism of that time really shocked me as somebody who lived through the 80s. To see how the language had changed gave me a great deal of comfort. And I guess what we, a lot of us, feel in this moment, or this movement, as Matt described it, is that we felt, I think, that the argument had been won several years ago, and that common sense and decency had prevailed. And I guess over the last two or three years, it's become apparent that not only has the argument not been won, that it's still the counter argument can now be made without feelings of shame or that that's the wrong argument, but the structures are still there and always have been there that work against black people in all walks of life, and that includes sport and it includes cycling. And, you know, there were just like little, you know, Matt, there were just little nuggets in what you said that, you know, that opened my eyes. I mean, the doctor he mentioned who when he met him said, oh, I didn't realize you were black, that would never go the other way. You know, you would never say to somebody, I didn't realize, you would never say to somebody, I didn't realize you were white. And that's just, it's just insidious, and it's working all the time. And that's something that I think it's good that we're all being made to be more aware of that.
The other thing I think we should do, chaps, is emphasise and point to the really positive developments and the people that have done a substantial amount to help. NTN story, what's now NTT, was Dimension Data. People have got mixed feelings about that because it's kind of, well, it was a team that was very public in the sort of mission it had to promote Black African cyclists, and to a large extent was very successful in doing that, but it's something that is much more marginal to the team's message now. I just looked at the numbers in 2012. They had 8 out of 17 of their riders were Black African riders, and it sort of continued in that vein. The high watermark was 9 out of 31 in 2017. Now they're only 2 out of 28 in 2019. But Napalm, we talked about the UCI and the importance of their role. I think that the greatest responsibility does really rely with the federations, and I think the NTT story, Dimension Data story, is a good example of how the teams are sometimes in this difficult position where they have to reconcile two sets of interests, the sort of moral interest, doing the right thing, with whatever their sponsor is dictating, the imperatives coming from their sponsor. And where things changed for that particular team, I think, was they signed Mark Cavendish in 2016, and he needed a certain type of support, and they needed more experienced riders, and slowly I think the original mission of the team was maybe lost slightly, which was a real shame, because I think we all thought, I think a lot of people at the time thought, it was a fantastic story. The African riders in the team, Daniel Tecklaheimer, not at the Tour de France in particular, I remember when he got the polka dot jersey a couple of days, got fantastic coverage. And it was, they were riders that I think most of us, the overwhelming majority, were really willing to do well and succeed. And part of me wishes that particular organization had doubled down on that part of their mission and that part of their story, rather than going in another direction. But we're not necessarily party to all of the factors that played into that, and also I'm loath to criticize an organization and someone like Doug Ryder, the principal of that team, who has done more 10 times, 100 times more than almost anyone else, because there aren't many channels, are there? I think the UCI has done some good work, the World Cycling Center, Matt also mentioned in the interview, they have produced a number of Black riders and riders also from other parts of the world that don't have a cycling heritage. Jean-René Bernadot at Total Direct Energy, he has championed the cause of Black French riders from Guadeloupe and Martinique and places like that. Johan Gen was one who rode the Tour de France in 2011. Since then, there have been more, but there aren't many channels. There have been sort of 3 or 4, and hopefully in the next few years they'll be multiplied. The other aspect I think it's worth mentioning is just the sort of messaging and the kind of rhetoric and the imagery around professional cycling, and particularly we always talk about how the Tour de France really sits above and over everything. And if you think about the image of France that sort of trades on and portrays, it's this kind of very sort of cutesy, old-fashioned and bucolic image of France with bunting, and it's a very sort of stereotypically white image. And this is something that I discussed with Christian Prudhomme last year. There was an initiative that had been in the works for a few years. The Tour de France was going to start a stage in a part of Toulouse which has a high proportion of ethnic minorities, and it's one of the poorer areas of Toulouse, and that happened. And there's been a great organization there called the Les Pichounes, which was set up a few years ago, which was set up to try to encourage young people in schools in this particular area of Toulouse to learn about the Tour de France. And they also produce a magazine every year on the Tour de France. How much impact is that going to have in the long term? It's certainly something. But when I did a story for ITV on that, and I did find myself wondering what will young people from areas like this see in the kind of imagery of the Tour de France that will resonate with them? Probably not a lot.
Hello, Cycling Podcast. It's Ed here from Bristol. I've got a question about podcasting. I've got a languages degree of pretty similar vintage to Daniel's, but unlike his, mine's gone fairly rusty over the intervening 20 or so years. So I was just wondering if you've got any recommendations for French or German language cycling podcasts that might help me polish off that rust.
French and German cycling podcast. Well, a German one I can recommend straight away is called Plan Z in English, and it is, the host is Rick Zabel, the pro rider, son of Eric Zabel, and he does sort of long form interviews. There've been a lot of prominent German riders on there, and it's a very good listen. The French one is more difficult. There have been a lot that have come and gone over the last few years. Off the top of my head, Rich, I'm struggling slightly, so anyone over the next few days who is interested in this subject should send me a message on Twitter, and I will respond with a more comprehensive list.
I like to think that Rick Zabel cut his podcasting teeth on the cycling podcast in the Friends special that Ian Boswell did during the 2018 Tour de France. He kept an audio diary for us, and he had Rick Zabel on a lot, and Rick Zabel was very good value, especially about the day that he climbed into the broom wagon. He was very funny. So maybe, you know, never know, can claim some credit for that.
Sort of led him out, podcasting-wise.
Hi, chaps. David Owen here, friend of the podcast. Ned Bolting recently was quoted as saying that he admired darts players as much as he did cyclists. So my question to you is, if any of the cyclists gave up cycling and become darts players, who'd be the best?
Well, this is one for me, really, isn't it? I'm a big fan of darts. 2007 Tour de France started in London, of course, and I was working for Cycle Sport magazine at the time, and I was absolutely mortified not to get an invitation to the Cricketers' Pub in Croydon, where some of the other darts-playing members of the staff had invited four riders to come down and play a couple of legs of darts. Charlie Wigelius and Enrico Degano were there. Geraint Thomas was there, and Filippo Pozzato was there.
Oh,
now,
God.
Now, photographic evidence of this exists, and I do remember sort of grilling everyone to find out how good or bad or indifferent they were at darts. Geraint Thomas, actually pretty handy, apparently hit a couple of treble 20s. I reckon, you know...
Can imagine that.
Yeah, you can
you
imagine.
Any good? I'm awful. Are you any good, Rich?
Not really.
My dad got through... There used to be a big tournament in the UK called the News of the World Tournament or Championship. He got through the first two rounds or something.
Wow. Well, Filippo Pozzato, as you'd imagine, was terrible at darts. But the funniest thing about it, apparently, was that he didn't go and retrieve his darts from the board. He expected somebody else to go and do that for him.
Of course
so,
he did.
So he threw his three darts and just stood there. How do these darts magically appear back in my hand for my next go?
Where are the darts domestiques?
Exactly.
When you need them?
But there is quite a tradition of darts and British cycling, isn't there? Back in the day, most cycling clubs would have had a dart board in the club room. In the clubhouse, a few legs of darts.
Really?
After time
never been in a cycling clubhouse.
Of course you haven't. Next question.
Hello, Daniel, Lionel and Richard. I greatly enjoyed the Our Giro coverage, and it got me subsequently pondering as to what might constitute the ultimate fantasy cycle race. At the risk of prompting the kind of wild speculation which Lionel is so fiercely opposed to, I was wondering what five cyclists from cycling's pantheon, crossing eras or whatever, you would like to see pitted against each other, and I suppose crucially, over what course?
I would like to see Rog, Pog, Remco, Bernal, and give me one other on the whole Tour de France route. Five, I'd like to see them ride the whole Tour de France route.
Peter Sagan.
Well, that would be interesting, wouldn't
what,
it?
What, just five of them do the tour?
Yeah, the whole tour.
Wow.
It'd be great. No drafting allowed. No, you could draft. You could have tactics. That'd be entertaining.
Yeah, like that.
How would that work?
What you're talking about is a time trial, Daniel.
Yes.
None of us want that.
No, we don't want that. This reminds me, actually, when we were doing our Giro episodes, I looked up the biggest winning margin in a Giro stage, and it was over an hour. I can't remember the name of the chap who won by that margin, but yeah, it'd be good to see that kind of thing again, wouldn't it?
It would be good, yeah. I'm not sure I can pick five riders, but we're quite... I do like these races where you see riders with different skill sets coming together, and Milan-San Remo is the obvious example. And, you know, when you see Nibali first and Caleb Ewan second, you think that's a great course, because people mock Milan-San Remo, but it's a race that suits so many riders that it can be fascinating. And then, you know, Nibali went to the Tour of Flanders, didn't he? And he actually made the move that won the race for Nicky Terpstra. And I watched that again recently, and Terps are bridged across to him. And I'm mentioning Nibali because he is a rider I like to see race on lots of different courses. Not really answering the question, though. Sorry, Dave.
Well, I'd like to see Eddie Merckx, Sean Kelly, Bernard Eno, Miguel Indurain, and Lance Armstrong, the controversial Lance Armstrong, all go clear on the Forest of Arenberg section of Paris-Roubaix, and then just five of them go head-to-head over the cobbles.
Not Jacques Anquetil?
No. No, not interested.
He's the obvious omission there.
Well, Roger de Vlaminck.
You'd
have to have
the question was five people. I mean, if we're gonna open the doors, we might as well have 150 riders and make a proper race of it.
De Vlaminck could be the first name on the team sheet in Paris-Roubaix, anyway.
Well, who would win that race, Lionel?
I think probably. It would come down to luck as much as anything, wouldn't it? Who punctures, any crashes? Probably Merckx, wouldn't he? Wouldn't Merckx win?
Yeah, but he's just turned 75.
Give him a chance. He's got to win Paris-Tours this year.
I assumed that we'd be selecting each rider in their pomp, not as they are now. Because otherwise, worryingly, Armstrong would probably win.
Hey guys, this is Patrick from the US. Outside of the Worlds, the Grand Tours, and the Monuments, what is your favorite race on the calendar? I'm also going to attempt to guess each of yours. For Richard, I'd say it's probably San Sebastian, because he's talked about how much he likes that race in general. And then Lionel, since he's the Lionel of Flanders, I'm going to guess Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. And then for Daniel, he's the real hard one here. So it's got to be Mediterranean. It's got to be, you know, off the beaten track. So I'm going to go to Portugal and say the Volta Algarve.
Well, thanks for that question. And especially given that we're almost at the end of the episode, thanks for answering it for us. That saves us a lot of racking of very tired brains at this stage. I don't know about you, but I'm almost dead on my feet here. San Sebastian, though, it's a lovely race. It's a beautiful city. I don't really like the time of year. It comes just a week after the Tour de France, and that diminishes it a little bit to me because nobody has really targeted it apart from Nicholas Roach, who targets it every year.
Balcom Mollema is a big fan.
Balcom Mollema, yeah. But, you know, nobody... on paper, it's a great race, and it's a beautiful part of the world. So I do like it, but I would move it in the calendar to somewhere else, some other time. I don't know when. Probably the start of the year.
Favourite race that you've never covered that you would love to cover?
Milan-San Remo. Never been to Milan-San Remo. Wow. And I have to say, Milan-San Remo might be my favourite race because it's the first big, you know, one-day classic of the year. Sorry about that, Lionel. I know that you like to think that's Het Nieuwsblad, but it's the one I feel the most anticipation for and the one that I enjoy watching the most, I think.
I'd go along with that, Rich. As far as one-day races are concerned, favourite race, if I had to cover one, I mean, Napalm or Bulk at this, but I always enjoy the Vuelta just because I think Spain is a fantastic country for a road trip. Great roads, lots of sort of unknown or little known to the wider public outside of Spain, mountain ranges as well that you often happen upon and take you by surprise. And I feel like I'm still discovering it after a few years of doing the Vuelta, so yeah.
Well, I've covered Het Nieuwsblad many times, even when it was called Het Volk. I'd also put very close, I've only been to Trobriand-Leon once, but I was absolutely smitten by that race, really. Not just the countryside and the little farm tracks, but just the whole atmosphere. And I thought it was a real shame when there was all those rumours that the Tour de France might go up into that corner of Brittany, and it didn't happen. Maybe one year. I'd love to see the Tour de France in on the farm tracks of Brittany and see whether it lives up to, well, the expectation, because they look fantastic and I think the racing would be fantastic as well.
Well, we should wrap things up, I think, chaps. We've gone on long enough. Sorry we haven't got through all your questions. As ever, we were inundated with questions and we've tried to get through as many of them as possible. We will do another press conference again soon. I had something to add there, but I can't now remember what it was. Can anybody remember what I had to add?
Daniel put a shirt on.
We've got two more episodes this week
on to go running in.
Service Course with Lizzie Banks and Tom Wally, and the Cycling Podcast Femina with me, Orla, and Rose. They're both out this week. We'll be back with our regular episode again next week, and our series will begin, My First Tour de France. Sign up as a friend of the podcast. I remember what I was going to say. I sent out an email this week to all of our very best friends of the podcast asking for ideas for a friend special. This is a tradition where those that are generous enough to throw £100 in the coffers to become a best friend of the podcast are invited to submit an idea. If you want to sign up as a friend of the podcast for £100, you can still submit an idea for consideration by July the 10th. So if you want to do that, thecyclingpodcast.com. That's all for this week. We'll be back next week. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.